Chapter 20. Too Late. In the street, they held an informal council of war. Sir James had drawn a watch from his pocket. "The boat train to Holyhead stops at Chester at 12:14. If you start at once, I think you can catch the connection." Tommy looked up, puzzled. "Is there any need to hurry, sir? Today is only the 24th." "I guess it's always well to get up early in the morning," said Julius, before the lawyer had time to reply. "We'll make tracks for the depot right away." A little frown had settled on Sir James's brow. "I wish I could come with you. I'm due to speak at a meeting at 2 o'clock. It is unfortunate." The reluctance in his tone was very evident. It was clear, on the other hand, that Julius was easily disposed to put up with the loss of the other's company. "I guess there's nothing complicated about this deal," he remarked. "Just a game of hide-and-seek, that's all." "I hope so," said Sir James. "Sure thing. What else could it be? You are still young, Mr. Hersheimer. At my age you will probably have learnt one lesson. Never underestimate your adversary." The gravity of his tone impressed Tommy, but had little effect upon Julius. "You think Mr. Brown might come along and take a hand? If he does, I'm ready for him." He slapped his pocket. "I carry a gun. Little Willie here travels round with me everywhere." He produced a murderous-looking automatic and tapped it affectionately before returning it to its home. "But he won't be needed this trip. There's nobody to put Mr. Brown wise." The lawyer shrugged his shoulders. "There was nobody to put Mr. Brown wise to the fact that Mrs. Vandermeer meant to betray him. Nevertheless, Mrs. Vandermeer died without speaking." Julius was silenced for once, and Sir James added, on a lighter note, "I only want to put you on your guard. Good-bye, and good luck. Take no unnecessary risks once the papers are in your hands. If there is any reason to believe that you have been shadowed, destroy them at once. Good luck to you. The game is in your hands now." He shook hands with them both. 10 minutes later, the two young men were seated in a first-class carriage en route for Chester. For a long time neither of them spoke. When at length Julius broke the silence, it was with a totally unexpected remark. "Say," he observed thoughtfully, "did you ever make a darn fool of yourself over a girl's face?" Tommy, after a moment's astonishment, searched his mind. "Can't say I have," he replied at last. "Not that I can recollect, anyhow. Why?" "Because for the last 2 months I've been making a sentimental idiot of myself over Jane. First moment I clapped eyes on her photograph, my heart did all the usual stunts you read about in novels. I guess I'm ashamed to admit it, but I came over here determined to find her and fix it all up and take her back as Mrs. Julius P. Hersheimer." "Oh," said Tommy, amazed. Julius uncrossed his legs brusquely and continued, "Just shows what an almighty fool a man can make of himself. One look at the girl in the flesh, and I was cured." Feeling more tongue-tied than ever, Tommy ejaculated, "Oh!" again. "No disparagement to Jane, mind you," continued the other. "She's a real nice girl, and some fellow will fall in love with her right away." "I thought her a very good-looking girl," said Tommy, finding his tongue. "Sure she is, but she's not like her photo one bit. At least, I suppose she is in a way. Must be, because I recognized her right off. If I'd seen her in a crowd, I'd have said, 'There's a girl whose face I know,' right away without any hesitation. But there was something about that photo." Julius shook his head and heaved a sigh. "I guess romance is a mighty queer thing." "It must be," said Tommy coldly. "If you can come over here in love with one girl and propose to another within a fortnight." Julius had the grace to look discomposed. "Well, you see, I'd got a sort of tired feeling that I'd never find Jane, and that it was all plumb foolishness anyway. And then, oh, well, the French, for instance, are much more sensible in the way they look at things. They keep romance and marriage apart." Tommy flushed. "Well, I'm damned! If that's—" Julius hastened to interrupt. "Say now, don't be hasty. I don't mean what you mean. I take it Americans have a higher opinion of morality than you have, even. What I meant was that the French set about marriage in a business-like way. Find two people who are suited to one another, look after the money affairs, and see the whole thing practically and in a business-like spirit. If you ask me, said Tommy, we're all too damn business-like nowadays. We're always saying, will it pay? The men are bad enough, and the girls are worse. Cool down, son. Don't get so heated. I feel heated, said Tommy. Julius looked at him and judged it wise to say no more. However, Tommy had plenty of time to cool down before they reached Holyhead, and the cheerful grin had returned to his countenance as they alighted at their destination. After consultation, and with the aid of a road map, they were fairly well agreed as to direction, so were able to hire a taxi without more ado and drive out on the road leading to Treava Bay. They instructed the man to go slowly and watched narrowly so as not to miss the path. They came to it not long after leaving the town, and Tommy stopped the car promptly, asked in a casual tone whether the path led down to the sea, and hearing it did, paid off the man in handsome style. A moment later, the taxi was slowly chugging back to Holyhead. Tommy and Julius watched it out of sight, and then turned to the narrow path. "It's the right one, I suppose?" asked Tommy doubtfully. "There must be simply heaps along here." "Sure it is. Look at the gorse. Remember what Jane said?" Tommy looked at the swelling hedges of golden blossom which bordered the path on either side and was convinced. They went down in single file, Julius leading. Twice Tommy turned his head uneasily. Julius looked back. "What is it?" "I don't know. I've got the wind up somehow. Keep fancying there's someone following us." "Can't be," said Julius positively. "We'd see him." Tommy had to admit that this was true. Nevertheless, his sense of uneasiness deepened. In spite of himself, he believed in the omniscience of the enemy. "I rather wish that fellow would come along," said Julius. He patted his pocket. "Little William here is just aching for exercise." "Do you always carry it him with you?" inquired Tommy with burning curiosity. "Most always. I guess you never know what might turn up." Tommy kept a respectful silence. He was impressed by little William. It seemed to remove the menace of Mr. Brown farther away. The path was now running along the side of the cliff, parallel to the sea. Suddenly Julius came to such an abrupt halt that Tommy cannoned into him. "What's up?" he inquired. "Look there, if that doesn't beat the band!" Tommy looked. Standing out and half-obstructing the path was a huge boulder, which certainly bore a fanciful resemblance to a begging terrier. "Well," said Tommy, refusing to share Julius's emotion, "it's what we expected to see, isn't it?" Julius looked at him sadly and shook his head. "British phlegm! Sure we expected it, but it kind of rattles me all the same to see it sitting there just where we expected to find it." Tommy, whose calm was perhaps more assumed than natural, moved his feet impatiently. "Push on! What about the hole?" They scanned the cliffside narrowly. Tommy heard himself saying idiotically, "The gorse won't be there after all these years." And Julius replied solemnly, "I guess you're right." Tommy suddenly pointed with a shaking hand. "What about that crevice there?" Julius replied in an awe-stricken voice. "That's it! For sure!" They looked at each other. "When I was in France," said Tommy reminiscently, "whenever my batman failed to call me, he always said that he had come over queer. I never believed it. But whether he felt it or not, there is such a sensation. I've got it now. Badly." He looked at the rock with a kind of agonized passion. "Damn it!" he cried. "It's impossible! 5 years, think of it! Birds nesting boys, picnic parties, thousands of people passing. It can't be there. It's 100 to 1 against its being there. It's against all reason." Indeed, he felt it to be impossible, more perhaps because he could not believe in his own success, where so many others have failed. The thing was too easy, therefore it could not be. The hole would be empty. Julius looked at him with a widening smile. "I guess you're rattled now, all right," he drawled with some enjoyment. "Well, here goes." He thrust his hand into the crevice and made a slight grimace. "It's a tight fit. Jane's hand must be a few sizes smaller than mine. I don't feel anything. Nope. Say, what's this? Gee whiz! And with a flourish he waved aloft a small discoloured packet. It's the goods, all right, sewn up in oilskin. Hold it while I get my penknife. The unbelievable had happened. Tommy held the precious packet tenderly between his hands. They had succeeded. It's queer, he murmured idly. You'd think the stitches would have rotted. They look just as good as new. They cut them carefully and ripped away the oilskin. Inside was a small folded sheet of paper. With trembling fingers they unfolded it. The sheet was blank. They stared at each other, puzzled. A dummy? Hazarded Julius. Was Danvers just a decoy? Tommy shook his head. That solution did not satisfy him. Suddenly his face cleared. I've got it! Sympathetic ink! You think so? Worth trying, anyhow. Heat usually does the trick. Get some sticks. We'll make a fire. In a few minutes the little fire of twigs and leaves was blazing merrily. Tommy held the sheet of paper near the glow. The paper curled a little with the heat, nothing more. Suddenly Julius grasped his arm and pointed to where characters were appearing in a faint brown colour. Gee whiz, you've got it! Say, that idea of yours was great. It never occurred to me. Tommy held the paper in position some minutes longer until he judged the heat had done its work. Then he withdrew it. A moment later he uttered a cry. Across the sheet, in neat brown printing, ran the words, "With the compliments of Mr. Brown." Chapter 21. Tommy makes a discovery. For a moment or two they stood staring at each other stupidly, dazed with the shock. Somehow, inexplicably, Mr. Brown had forestalled them. Tommy accepted defeat quietly, not so Julius. "How in tarnation did he get ahead of us? That's what beats me," he ended up. Tommy shook his head and said dully, "It accounts for the stitches being new. We might have guessed. Never mind the darn stitches. How did he get ahead of us? We hustled all we knew. It's downright impossible for anyone to get here quicker than we did. And anyway, how did he know? Do you reckon there was a dictaphone in Jane's room? I guess there must have been." But Tommy's common sense pointed out objections. No one could have known beforehand that she was going to be in that house, much less that particular room. "That's so," admitted Julius. "Then one of the nurses was a crook and listened at the door. How's that?" "I don't see that it matters anyway," said Tommy wearily. "He may have found out some months ago and removed the papers then. No, by Jove, that won't wash. They'd have been published at once." "Sure thing they would. No, someone's got ahead of us today by an hour or so. But how they did it gets my goat." "I wish that chap Peel Edgerton had been with us," said Tommy thoughtfully. "Why?" Julius stared. "The mischief was done when we came." "Yes." Tommy hesitated. He could not explain his own feeling, the illogical idea that the Casey's presence would somehow have averted the catastrophe. He reverted to his former point of view. "It's no good arguing about how it was done. The game's up. We've failed. There's only one thing for me to do." "What's that?" "Get back to London as soon as possible. Mr. Carter must be warned. It's only a matter of hours now before the blow falls, but at any rate he ought to know the worst." The duty was an unpleasant one, but Tommy had no intention of shirking it. He must report his failure to Mr. Carter. After that his work was done. He took the midnight mail to London. Julius elected to stay the night at Holyhead. Half an hour after arrival, haggard and pale, Tommy stood before his chief.
"I've come to report, sir. I've failed. Failed badly."
Mr. Carter eyed him sharply.
"You mean that the treaty is in the hands of Brown, sir?"
"Ah," said Mr. Carter quietly. The expression on his face did not change, but Tommy caught the flicker of despair in his eyes. It convinced him, as nothing else had done, that the outlook was hopeless.
"Well," said Mr. Carter after a minute or two, "we mustn't sag at the knees, I suppose. I'm glad to know definitely. We must do what we can."
Through Tommy's mind flashed the assurance, "It's hopeless, and he knows it's hopeless." The other looked up at him.
"Don't take it to heart, lad," he said kindly. "You did your best. You were up against one of the biggest brains of the century. and you came very near success, remember that? Thank you, sir. It's awfully decent of you. I blame myself. I've been blaming myself ever since I heard this other news. Something in his tone attracted Tommy's attention. A new fear gripped at his heart. Is there something more, sir? I'm afraid so, said Mr. Carter gravely. He stretched out his hand to a sheet on the table. Tuppence, faltered Tommy. Read for yourself. The typewritten words danced before his eyes. The description of a green toque, a coat with a handkerchief in the pocket marked PLC. He looked an agonized question at Mr. Carter. The latter replied to it. Washed up on the Yorkshire coast, near Ebury. I'm afraid it looks very much like foul play. My God! Gasped Tommy. Tuppence! Those devils! I'll never rest till I've got even with them. I'll hunt them down, I'll— The pity on Mr. Carter's face stopped him. I know what you feel like, my poor boy, but it's no good. You'll waste your strength uselessly. It may sound harsh, but my advice to you is cut your losses. Time's merciful, you'll forget. Forget tuppence, never. Mr. Carter shook his head. So you think now? Well, it won't bear thinking of, that brave little girl. I'm sorry about the whole business, confoundedly sorry. Tommy came to himself with a start. I'm taking up your time, sir, he said with an effort. There's no need for you to blame yourself. I dare say we were a couple of young fools to take on such a job. You warned us all right. But I wish to God I'd been the one to get it in the neck. Goodbye, sir. Back at the Ritz, Tommy packed up his few belongings mechanically, his thoughts far away. He was still bewildered by the introduction of tragedy into his cheerful, commonplace existence. What fun they had had together, he and Tuppence. And now— Oh, he couldn't believe it. It couldn't be true. Tuppence? Dead? Little Tuppence brimming over with life? It was a dream. A horrible dream, nothing more. They brought him a note, a few kind words of sympathy from Peel Edgerton, who had read the news in the paper. There had been a large headline, XVAD feared drowned. The letter ended with the offer of a post on a ranch in the Argentine, where Sir James had considerable interests. Kind old beggar, muttered Tommy as he flung it aside. The door opened, and Julius burst in with his usual violence. He held an open newspaper in his hand. Say, what's all this? I seem to have got some fool idea about Tuppence. It's true, said Tommy quietly. You mean they've done her in? Tommy nodded. I suppose when they got the treaty she wasn't any good to them any longer, and they were afraid to let her go. Well, I'm darned, said Julius. Little Tuppence! She sure was the pluckiest little girl! But suddenly something seemed to crack in Tommy's brain. He rose to his feet. Oh, get out! You don't really care, damn you! You asked her to marry you in your rotten, cold-blooded way, but I loved her. I'd have given the soul out of my body to save her from harm. I'd have stood by without a word and let her marry you, because you could have given her the sort of time she ought to have had, and I was only a poor devil without a penny to bless himself with. But it wouldn't have been because I didn't care. See here, began Julius temperately. Oh, go to the devil. I can't stand your coming here and talking about little Tuppence. Go and look after your cousin. Tuppence is my girl. I've always loved her from the time we played together as kids. We grew up and it was just the same. I shall never forget when I was in hospital and she came in that ridiculous cap and apron. It was like a miracle to see the girl I love turn up in a nurse's kit. But Julius interrupted him. A nurse's kit? Gee whiz, I must be going to Colney Hatch. I could swear I've seen Jane in a nurse's cap too, and that's plumb impossible. No, by gum, I've got it. It was her I saw talking to Whittington at that nursing home in Bournemouth. She wasn't a patient there, she was a nurse. I dare say, said Tommy angrily. She's probably been in with them from the start. I shouldn't wonder if she stole those papers from Danvers to begin with. I'm darned if she did, shouted Julius. She's my cousin and as patriotic a girl as ever stepped. I don't care a damn what she is, but get out of here, retorted Tommy, also at the top of his voice. The young men were on the point of coming to blows. But suddenly, with an almost magical abruptness, Julius's anger abated. All right, son, he said quietly. I'm going.
I don't blame you any for what you've been saying. It's mighty lucky you did say it. I've been the most almighty blithering darned idiot that it's possible to imagine. Calm down. Tommy had made an impatient gesture. I'm going right away now. Going to the London and North Western Railway Depot, if you want to know. I don't care a damn where you're going, growled Tommy. As the door closed behind Julius, he returned to his suitcase. That's the lot, he murmured, and rang the bell. Take my luggage down. Yes, sir. Hang away, sir. I'm going to the devil, said Tommy, regardless of the menial's feelings. That functionary, however, merely replied respectfully, Yes, sir. Shall I call a taxi? Tommy nodded. Where was he going? He hadn't the faintest idea. Beyond a fixed determination to get even with Mr. Brown, he had no plans. He re-read Sir James's letter and shook his head. Tuppence must be avenged. Still, it was kind of the old fellow. Better answer it, I suppose. He went across to the writing table. With the usual perversity of bedroom stationery, there were innumerable envelopes and no paper. He rang, no one came. Tommy fumed at the delay. Then he remembered that there was a good supply in Julius's sitting room. The American had announced his immediate departure. There would be no fear of running up against him. Besides, he wouldn't mind if he did. He was beginning to be rather ashamed of the things he had said. Oh, Julius had taken them jolly well. He'd apologize if he found him there. But the room was deserted. Tommy walked across to the writing table and opened the middle drawer. A photograph, carelessly thrust in, face upwards, caught his eye. For a moment he stood rooted to the ground. Then he took it out, shut the drawer, walked slowly over to an armchair, and sat down, still staring at the photograph in his hand. What on earth was a photograph of the French girl Annette doing in Julius Hirschheimer's writing table? Chapter 22 In Downing Street. The Prime Minister tapped the desk in front of him with nervous fingers. His face was worn and harassed. He took up his conversation with Mr. Carter at the point it had broken off.
"I don't understand," he said. "Do you really mean that things are not so desperate after all?" "So this lad seems to think. Let's have a look at his letter again."
Mr. Carter handed it over. It was written in a sprawling, boyish hand.
"Dear Mr. Carter, something's turned up that has given me a jar. Of course, I may be simply making an awful ass of myself, but I don't think so. If my conclusions are right, that girl at Manchester was just a plant. The whole thing was prearranged, sham packet and all, with the object of making us think the game was up. Therefore, I fancy that we must have been pretty hot on the scent. I think I know who the real Jane Finn is, and I've even got an idea where the papers are. At last, only a guess, of course, but I've a sort of feeling it'll turn out right. Anyhow, I enclose it in a sealed envelope for what it's worth. I'm going to ask you not to open it until the very last moment, midnight on the 28th, in fact. You'll understand why in a minute. You see, I've figured it out that those things of Tuppence's are a plant, too, and she's no more drowned than I am. The way I reason is this. As a last chance, they let Jane Finn escape, in the hope that she's been shamming this memory stunt, and that once she thinks she's free, she'll go right away to the cash. Of course, it's an awful risk for them to take, because she knows all about them, but they're pretty desperate to get hold of that treaty. But if they know that the papers have been recovered by us, neither of those two girls' lives will be worth an hour's purchase. I must try and get hold of Tuppence before Jane escapes. I want a repeat of that telegram that was sent to Tuppence at the Ritz. Sir James Peel Edgerton said you would be able to manage that for me. He's frightfully clever. One last thing. Please have that house in Soho watched day and night. Yours, etc., Thomas Beresford.
The Prime Minister looked up.
The enclosure?
Mr. Carter smiled dryly.
In the vaults of the bank, I am taking no chances. You don't think,
the Prime Minister hesitated a minute,
that it would be better to open it now? Surely we ought to secure the document, that is, provided the young man's guess turns out to be correct, at once. We can keep the fact of having done so quite secret.
Can we? I'm not so sure. There are spies all round us.
Once it's known, I wouldn't give that, he snapped his fingers. For the life of those two girls? No, the boy trusted me, and I shan't let him down. "Well, well, we must leave it at that, then. What's he like, this lad?"
"Outwardly, he's an ordinary, clean-limbed, rather block-headed young Englishman, slow in his mental processes. On the other hand, it's quite impossible to lead him astray through his imagination. He hasn't got any, so he's difficult to deceive. He worries things out slowly, and once he's got hold of anything, he doesn't let go. The little lady's quite different, more intuition and less common sense. They make a pretty pair, working together, pace and stamina."
"He seems confident," mused the Prime Minister.
"Yes, and that's what gives me hope. He's the kind of diffident youth who would have to be very sure before he ventured an opinion at all." A half-smile came to the other's lips.
"And it is this boy who will defeat the master criminal of our time?"
"This boy, as you say. But I sometimes fancy I see a shadow behind."
"You mean Peel Egerton?"
"Peel Egerton?" said the Prime Minister in astonishment.
"Yes, I see his hand in this." He struck the open letter. "He's there, working in the dark, silently, unobtrusively. I've always felt that if anyone was to run Mr. Brown to earth, Peel Egerton would be the man. I tell you he's on the case now, but doesn't want it known. By the way, I got rather an odd request from him the other day."
"Yes?"
"He sent me a cutting from some American paper. It referred to a man's body found near the docks in New York about 3 weeks ago. He asked me to collect any information on the subject I could."
"Well?"
Carter shrugged his shoulders.
"I couldn't get much. Young fellow, about 35, poorly dressed, face very badly disfigured. He was never identified."
"And you fancy that the two matters are connected in some way?"
"Somehow I do. I may be wrong, of course."
There was a pause, then Mr. Carter continued. "I asked him to come round here. Not that we'll get anything out of him, he doesn't want to tell. His legal instincts are too strong. But there's no doubt he can throw light on one or two obscure points in young Beresford's letter. Ah, here he is."
The two men rose to greet the newcomer. A half-whimsical thought flashed across the Premier's mind.
"My successor, perhaps."
"We've had a letter from young Beresford," said Mr. Carter, coming to the point at once. "You've seen him, I suppose?"
"You suppose wrong," said the lawyer.
"Oh."
Mr. Carter was a little nonplussed. Sir James smiled and stroked his chin.
"He rang me up," he volunteered.
"Would you have any objection to telling us exactly what passed between you?"
"Not at all. He thanked me for a certain letter which I had written to him. As a matter of fact, I had offered him a job.
Then he reminded me of something I had said to him at Manchester respecting that bogus telegram which lured Miss Cowley away. I asked him if anything untoward had occurred. He said it had, that in a drawer in Mr. Hersheimer's room he had discovered a photograph."
The lawyer paused, then continued,
"I asked him if the photograph bore the name and address of a California photographer. He replied, 'You're on to it, sir, it had.' Then he went on to tell me something I didn't know. The original of that photograph was the French girl Annette who saved his life."
"What?"
"Exactly. I asked the young man with some curiosity what he had done with the photograph. He replied that he had put it back where he found it."
The lawyer paused again.
"That was good, you know, distinctly good. He can use his brains, that young fellow. I congratulated him. The discovery was a providential one. Of course, from the moment that the girl in Manchester was proved to be a plant, everything was altered. Young Beresford saw that for himself without my having to tell it him. But he felt he couldn't trust his judgment on the subject of Miss Cowley. Did I think she was alive? I told him, duly weighing the evidence, that there was a very decided chance in favour of it. That brought us back to the telegram."
"Yes?"
"I advised him to apply to you for a copy of the original wire. It had occurred to me as probable that, after Miss Cowley flung it on the floor, certain words might have been erased and altered with the express intention of setting searchers on a false trail."
Carter nodded. He took a sheet from his pocket and read aloud,
"Come at once. Astley Priors, Gatehouse, Kent, Great Developments, Tommy."
"Very simple," said Sir James, "and very ingenious.
Just a few words to alter, and the thing was done. And the one important clue they overlooked. What was that? The page boy's statement that Miss Cowley drove to Charing Cross. They were so sure of themselves that they took it for granted he had made a mistake. Then young Beresford is now at Gatehouse, Kent, unless I am much mistaken.
Mr. Carter looked at him curiously.
I rather wonder you're not there too, Peel Egerton.
Ah, I'm busy on a case.
I thought you were on your holiday.
Oh, I've not been briefed.
Perhaps it would be more correct to say I'm preparing a case.
Any more facts about that American chap for me?
I'm afraid not. Is it important to find out who he was?
Oh, I know who he was, said Sir James easily. I can't prove it yet, but I know.
The other two asked no questions. They had an instinct that it would be mere waste of breath.
But what I don't understand, said the Prime Minister suddenly, is how that photograph came to be in Mr. Hirschheimer's drawer.
Perhaps it never left it, suggested the lawyer gently.
But the bogus inspector, Inspector Brown.
Ah, said Sir James thoughtfully. He rose to his feet.
I mustn't keep you. Go on with the affairs of the nation. I must get back to my case.
2 days later, Julius Hirschheimer returned from Manchester. A note from Tommy lay on his table.
Dear Hirschheimer, sorry I lost my temper. In case I don't see you again, goodbye. I've been offered a job in the Argentine and might as well take it. Yours, Tommy Beresford.
A peculiar smile lingered for a moment on Julius's face. He threw the letter into the waste paper basket.
The darn fool, he murmured.
Chapter 23. A Race Against Time. After ringing up Sir James, Tommy's next procedure was to make a call at South Audley Mansions. He found Albert discharging his professional duties, and introduced himself without more ado as a friend of Tuppence's. Albert unbent immediately.
"Things has been very quiet here lately," he said wistfully. "Hope the young lady's keeping well, sir?"
"That's just the point, Albert. She's disappeared."
"You don't mean as the crooks have got her?"
"They have."
"In the underworld?"
"No, dash it, all in this world."
"It's her expression, sir," explained Albert. "And the pictures, the crooks always have a restaurant in the underworld. But do you think as they've done her in, sir?"
"I hope not."
"By the way, have you by any chance an aunt, a cousin, a grandmother, or any other suitable female relation who might be represented as being likely to kick the bucket?"
A delighted grin spread slowly over Albert's countenance.
"I'm on, sir. My poor aunt, what lives in the country, has been mortal bad for a long time, and she's asking for me with her dying breath."
Tommy nodded approval.
"Can you report this in the proper quarter and meet me at Charing Cross in an hour's time? I'll be there, sir. You can count on me."
As Tommy had judged, the faithful Albert proved an invaluable ally. The two took up their quarters at the inn in Gatehouse. To Albert fell the task of collecting information. There was no difficulty about it. Astley Priors was the property of a Dr. Adams. The doctor no longer practised. He had retired, the landlord believed, but he took a few private patients. Here the good fellow tapped his forehead knowingly.
Barmy ones, you understand?
The doctor was a popular figure in the village, subscribed freely to all the local sports. Very pleasant, affable gentleman.
Been there long? Oh, a matter of 10 years or so. Might be longer. Scientific gentleman he was. Professors and people often came down from town to see him. Anyway, it was a gay house, always visitors.
In the face of all this volubility, Tommy felt doubts. Was it possible that this genial, well-known figure could be in reality a dangerous criminal? His life seemed so open and above board. No hint of sinister doings. Suppose it was all a gigantic mistake. Tommy felt a cold chill at the thought. Then he remembered the private patients, balmy ones. He inquired carefully if there was a young lady amongst them, describing Tuppence. But nothing much seemed to be known about the patients. They were seldom seen outside the grounds. A guarded description of Annette also failed to provoke recognition. Astley Priors was a pleasant red-brick edifice surrounded by well-wooded grounds, which effectually shielded the house from observation from the road. On the first evening, Tommy, accompanied by Albert, explored the grounds. Owing to Albert's insistence, they dragged themselves along painfully on their stomachs, thereby producing a great deal more noise than if they had stood upright. In any case, these precautions were totally unnecessary. The grounds, like those of any other private house after nightfall, seemed untenanted. Tommy had imagined a possible fierce watchdog. Albert's fancy ran to a puma or a tame cobra, but they reached a shrubbery near the house quite unmolested. The blinds of the dining-room window were up. There was a large company assembled round the table. The port was passing from hand to hand. It seemed a normal, pleasant company. Through the open window, scraps of conversation floated out disjointedly on the night air. It was a heated discussion on county cricket. Again, Tommy felt that cold chill of uncertainty. It seemed impossible to believe that these people were other than they seemed. Had he been fooled once more? The fair, bearded, spectacled gentleman who sat at the head of the table looked singularly honest and normal. Tommy slept badly that night. The following morning, the indefatigable Albert, having cemented an alliance with the greengrocer's boy, took the latter's place and ingratiated himself with the cook at Malthouse. He returned with the information that she was undoubtedly one of the crooks, but Tommy mistrusted the vividness of his imagination. Questioned, he could adduce nothing in support of his statement, except his own opinion that she wasn't the usual kind. You could see that at a glance. The substitution being repeated, much to the pecuniary advantage of the real greengrocer's boy, on the following day, Albert brought back the first piece of hopeful news. There was a French young lady staying in the house. Tommy put his doubts aside. Here was confirmation of his theory. But time pressed. Today was the 27th. The 29th was the much-talked-of Labour Day, about which all sorts of rumours were running riot. Newspapers were getting agitated. Sensational hints of a Labour coup d'etat were freely reported. The government said nothing. It knew and was prepared. They were not of one mind. The more far-seeing among them realised that what they proposed might well be a death blow to the England that at heart they loved. They shrank from the starvation and misery a general strike would entail, and were willing to meet the government halfway. But behind them were subtle, insistent forces at work, urging the memories of old wrongs, deprecating the weakness of half-and-half measures, fomenting misunderstandings. Tommy felt that, thanks to Mr. Carter, he understood the position fairly accurately. With the fatal document in the hands of Mr. Brown, public opinion would swing to the side of the Labour extremists and revolutionists. Failing that, the battle was an even chance. The government, with a loyal army and police force behind them, might win, but at a cost of great suffering. But Tommy nourished another and a preposterous dream. With Mr. Brown unmasked and captured, he believed, rightly or wrongly, that the whole organisation would crumble ignominiously and instantaneously. The strange, permeating influence of the unseen chief held it together. Without him, Tommy believed, an instant panic would set in, and the honest men left to themselves, an 11th-hour reconciliation would be possible. "This is a one-man show," said Tommy to himself. "The thing to do is to get hold of the man." It was partly in furtherance of this ambitious design that he had requested Mr. Carter not to open the sealed envelope. The draft treaty was Tommy's bait. Every now and then he was aghast at his own presumption. How dare he think that he had discovered what so many wiser and cleverer men had overlooked? Nevertheless, he stuck tenaciously to his idea. That evening, he and Albert once more penetrated the grounds of Astley Priors. Tommy's ambition was somehow or other to gain admission to the house itself. As they approached cautiously, Tommy gave a sudden gasp. On the second-floor window, someone standing between the window and the light in the room threw a silhouette on the blind. It was one Tommy would have recognised anywhere. Tuppence was in that house. He clutched Albert by the shoulder. "Stay here. When I begin to sing, watch that window." He retreated hastily to a position on the main drive, and began in a deep roar, coupled with an unsteady gait, the following ditty.
I am a soldier, a jolly British soldier. You can see that I'm a soldier by my feet.
It had been a favourite on the gramophone in Tuppence's hospital days. He did not doubt but that she would recognise it and draw her own conclusions. Tommy had not a note of music in his voice, but his lungs were excellent. The noise he produced was terrific. Presently, an unimpeachable butler, accompanied by an equally unimpeachable footman, issued from the front door. The butler remonstrated with him. Tommy continued to sing, addressing the butler affectionately as, "Dear old Whiskers!" The footman took him by one arm, the butler by the other. They ran him down the drive and neatly out of the gate. The butler threatened him with the police if he intruded again. It was beautifully done, soberly and with perfect decorum. Anyone would have sworn that the butler was a real butler, the footman a real footman. Only as it happened, the butler was Whittington. Tommy retired to the inn and waited for Albert's return. At last that worthy made his appearance.
"Well," cried Tommy eagerly, "it's all right. While they was a-running you out, the window opened and something was chucked out."
He handed a scrap of paper to Tommy.
"It was wrapped round a letter-weight."
On the paper were scrawled three words. "Tomorrow, same time."
"Good egg!" cried Tommy. "We're getting going." "I wrote a message on a piece of paper, wrapped it round a stone and chucked it through the window,"
continued Albert breathlessly. Tommy groaned.
"Oh, your zeal will be the undoing of us, Albert. What did you say?" "Said we was a-staying at the inn, if she could get away to come there and croak like a frog." "Oh, she'll know that's you," said Tommy with a sigh of relief. "Your imagination runs away with you, you know, Albert. Why, you wouldn't recognise a frog croaking if you heard it."
Albert looked rather crestfallen.
"Cheer up," said Tommy, "no harm done. That butler's an old friend of mine. I bet he knew who I was, though he didn't let on. It's not their game to show suspicion. That's why we found it fairly plain sailing. They don't want to discourage me altogether. On the other hand, they don't want to make it too easy. I'm a pawn in their game, Albert, that's what I am. You see, if the spider lets the fly walk out too easily, the fly might suspect it was a put-up job. Hence the usefulness of that promising youth Mr. T. Beresford, who's blundered in just at the right moment for them. But later, Mr. T. Beresford had better look out."
Tommy retired for the night in a state of some elation. He had elaborated a careful plan for the following evening. He felt sure that the inhabitants of Astley Priors would not interfere with him, up to a certain point. It was after that that Tommy proposed to give them a surprise. About 12 o'clock, however, his calm was rudely shaken. He was told that someone was demanding him in the bar. The applicant proved to be a rude-looking carter, well coated with mud.
"Well, my good fellow, what is it?" asked Tommy. "Might this be for you, sir?"
The carter held out a very dirty folded note, on the outside of which was written, "Take this to the gentleman at the inn near Astley Priors. He will give you 10 shillings." The handwriting was Tuppence's. Tommy appreciated her quick-wittedness in realising that he might be staying at the inn under an assumed name. He snatched at it.
"That's all right."
The man withheld it.
"What about my 10 shillings?"
Tommy hastily produced a 10-shilling note, and the man relinquished his find. Tommy unfastened it.
"Dear Tommy, I knew it was you last night. Don't go this evening, they'll be lying in wait for you. They're taking us away this morning. I heard something about Wales, Holyhead, I think. I'll drop this on the road if I get a chance. Annette told me how you'd escaped. Back up. Yours, Tuppence."
Tommy raised a shout for Albert before he had even finished perusing this characteristic epistle.
"Pack my bag, we're off!"
"Yes, sir!"
The boots of Albert could be heard racing upstairs. Holyhead? Did that mean that after all... Tommy was puzzled. He read on slowly. The boots of Albert continued to be active on the floor above. Suddenly a second shout came from below.
"Albert! I'm a damned fool! Unpack that bag!"
"Yes, sir!"
Tommy smoothed out the note thoughtfully.
"Yes, a damned fool," he said softly. "But so's someone else. And at last I know who it is."
Chapter 24. Julius takes a hand. In his suite at Claridge's, Kramenin reclined on a couch and dictated to his secretary in sibilant Russian. Presently the telephone at the secretary's elbow purred, and he took up the receiver, spoke for a minute or two, then turned to his employer.
"Someone below is asking for you."
"Who is it?"
"He gives the name of Mr. Julius P. Hirschheimer."
"Hirschheimer," repeated Kramenin thoughtfully. "I have heard that name before."
"His father was one of the Steel Kings of America," explained the secretary, whose business it was to know everything. "This young man must be a millionaire several times over."
The other's eyes narrowed appreciatively.
"You had better go down and see him, Ivan. Find out what he wants."
The secretary obeyed, closing the door noiselessly behind him. In a few minutes he returned.
"He declines to state his business, says it is entirely private and personal, and that he must see you."
"A millionaire several times over," murmured Kramenin. "Bring him up, my dear Ivan."
The secretary left the room once more and returned escorting Julius.
"Monsieur Kramenin," said the latter abruptly.
The Russian, studying him attentively with his pale, venomous eyes, bowed.
"Pleased to meet you," said the American. "I've got some very important business I'd like to talk over with you, if I can see you alone."
He looked pointedly at the other.
"My secretary, Monsieur Grieber, from whom I have no secrets."
"That may be so, but I have," said Julius dryly. "So I'd be obliged if you'd tell him to scoot."
"Ivan," said the Russian softly, "perhaps you would not mind retiring into the next room."
"The next room won't do," interrupted Julius. "I know these ducal suites, and I want this one plumb empty except for you and me. Send him round to a store to buy a penn'orth of peanuts."
Although not particularly enjoying the American's free and easy manner of speech, Kramenin was devoured by curiosity.
"Will your business take long to state?"
"Might be an all-night job if you caught on."
"Very good, Ivan. I shall not require you again this evening. Go to the theatre. Take a night off."
"Thank you, Your Excellency."
The secretary bowed and departed. Julius stood at the door watching his retreat. Finally, with a satisfied sigh, he closed it and came back to his position in the centre of the room.
"Now, Mr. Hirschheimer, perhaps you will be so kind as to come to the point."
"I guess that won't take a minute," drawled Julius.
Then, with an abrupt change of manner,
"Hands up or I shoot."
For a moment, Kramenin stared blindly into the big automatic. Then, with almost comical haste, he flung up his hands above his head. In that instant, Julius had taken his measure. The man he had to deal with was an abject physical coward. The rest would be easy.
"This is an outrage!" cried the Russian in a high, hysterical voice. "An outrage! Do you mean to kill me?" "Not if you keep your voice down. Don't go edging sideways towards that bell. That's better." "What do you want? Do nothing rashly. Remember, my life is of the utmost value to my country. I may have been maligned."
"I reckon," said Julius, "that the man who let daylight into you would be doing humanity a good turn. But you needn't worry any. I'm not proposing to kill you this trip. That is, if you're reasonable."
The Russian quailed before the stern menace in the other's eyes. He passed his tongue over his dry lips.
"What do you want? Money?"
"No, I want Jane Finn."
"Jane Finn? I never heard of her."
"You're a darned liar. You know perfectly who I mean."
"I tell you, I've never heard of the girl."
"And I tell you," retorted Julius, "that little Willie here is just hopping mad to go off."
The Russian wilted visibly.
"You wouldn't dare."
"Oh, yes, I would, son."
Kramenin must have recognized something in the voice that carried conviction, for he said sullenly,
"Well, granted I do know who you mean. What of it?"
"You will tell me now, right here, where she is to be found."
Kramenin shook his head.
"I daren't."
"Why not?"
"I daren't. You ask an impossibility."
"Afraid, eh? Of whom? Mr. Brown? Ah, that tickles you up. There is such a person then, huh? I doubted it.
and the mere mention of him scares you stiff.
I have seen him, said the Russian slowly, spoken to him face to face. I did not know it until afterwards. He was one of a crowd. I should not know him again. Who is he really? I do not know. But I know this. He is a man to fear.
He'll never know, said Julius.
He knows everything, and his vengeance is swift. Even I, Kremenin, would not be exempt.
Then you won't do as I ask you?
You ask an impossibility.
Sure, that's a pity for you, said Julius cheerfully. But the world in general will benefit.
He raised the revolver.
Stop! Shrieked the Russian. You cannot mean to shoot me.
Of course I do. I've always heard you revolutionists held life cheap. But it seems there's a difference when it's your own life in question. I gave you just one chance of saving your dirty skin, and that you wouldn't take.
They would kill me.
Well, said Julius pleasantly, it's up to you. But I'll just say this. Little Willie here is a dead cert, and if I was you, I'd take a sporting chance with Mr. Brown.
You will hang if you shoot me, muttered the Russian irresolutely.
No, stranger, that's where you're wrong. You forget the dollars. A big crowd of solicitors will get busy, and they'll get some highbrow doctors on the job, and the end of it all will be that they'll say my brain was unhinged. I shall spend a few months in a quiet sanatorium. My mental health will improve. The doctors will declare me sane again, and all will end happily for little Julius. I guess I can bear a few months' retirement in order to rid the world of you, but don't you kid yourself, I'll hang for it.
The Russian believed him. Corrupt himself, he believed implicitly in the power of money. He had read of American murder trials running much on the lines indicated by Julius. He had bought and sold justice himself. This virile young American with a significant drawling voice had the whip hand of him.
"I'm going to count five," continued Julius, "and I guess if you let me get past four, you needn't worry any about Mr. Brown. Maybe he'll send some flowers to the funeral, but you won't smell them. Are you ready? I'll begin. One, two, three, four,"
the Russian interrupted with a shriek.
"Do not shoot! I will do all you wish!"
Julius lowered the revolver.
"I thought you'd hear sense. Where is the girl?"
"At Gatehouse, in Kent. Astley Priors, the place is called.
Is she a prisoner there?"
"She's not allowed to leave the house, though it's safe enough, really. The little fool has lost her memory, curse her."
"That's been annoying for you and your friends, I reckon. What about the other girl, the one you decoyed away over a week ago?"
"She's there, too," said the Russian sullenly.
"That's good," said Julius. "Isn't it all panning out beautifully, and a lovely night for the run?"
"What run?"
demanded Kremenin with a stare.
"Down to Gatehouse, sure. Hope you're fond of motoring."
"What do you mean? I refuse to go."
"Now, don't get mad. You must see I'm not such a kid as to leave you here. You'd ring up your friends on that telephone first thing." "Ah," he observed the fall on the other's face. "You see, you'd got it all fixed. No, sir, you're coming along with me. This your bedroom next door here? Walk right in. Little Willie and I will come behind. Put on a thick coat, that's right. Fur-lined, and you a socialist. Huh. Now we're ready. We walk downstairs and out through the hall to where my car is waiting. And don't you forget, I've got you covered every inch of the way. I can shoot just as well through my coat pocket. One word or a glance even at one of those liveried menials, and there'll sure be a strange face in the sulphur and brimstone works."
Together they descended the stairs and passed out to the waiting car. The Russian was shaking with rage. The hotel servants surrounded them. A cry hovered on his lips, but at the last minute his nerve failed him. The American was a man of his word. When they reached the car, Julius breathed a sigh of relief. The danger zone was past. Fear had successfully hypnotized the man by his side.
"Get in," he ordered.
Then, as he caught the other's sidelong glance,
"No, the chauffeur won't help you any. Naval man, was on a submarine in Russia when the revolution broke out. A brother of his was murdered by your people."
"George?"
"Yes, sir?"
The chauffeur turned his head.
"This gentleman is a Russian Bolshevik. We don't want to shoot him, but it may be necessary. You understand?"
"Perfectly, sir." "I want to go to Gatehouse in Kent. Know the road at all?"
"Yes, sir. It will be about an hour and a half's run."
"Make it an hour. I'm in a hurry.
"'I'll do my best, sir.' The car shot forward through the traffic. Julius ensconced himself comfortably by the side of his victim. He kept his hand in the pocket of his coat, but his manner was urbane to the last degree. "'There was a man I shot once in Arizona,' he began cheerfully. At the end of the hour's run, the unfortunate Kremenin was more dead than alive. In succession to the anecdote of the Arizona man, there had been a tough from Frisco and an episode in the Rockies. Julius's narrative style, if not strictly accurate, was picturesque. Slowing down, the chauffeur called over his shoulder that they were just coming into Gatehouse. Julius bade the Russian direct them. His plan was to drive straight up to the house. There, Kremenin was to ask for the two girls. Julius explained to him that little Willie would not be tolerant of failure. Kremenin, by this time, was putty in the other's hands. The terrific pace they had come had still further unmanned him. He had given himself up for dead at every corner. The car swept up the drive and stopped before the porch. The chauffeur looked round for orders. "Turn the car first, George, then ring the bell and get back to your place. Keep the engine going and be ready to scoot like hell when I give the word." "Very good, sir." The front door was opened by the butler. Kremenin felt the muzzle of the revolver pressing against his ribs. "Now," hissed Julius, "and be careful." The Russian beckoned. His lips were white, and his voice was not very steady.
"It is I, Kremenin. Bring down the girl at once. There's no time to lose."
Whittington had come down the steps. He uttered an exclamation of astonishment at seeing the other.
"You? What's up? Surely you know the plan?"
Kremenin interrupted him, using the words that have created many unnecessary panics.
"We have been betrayed. Plans must be abandoned. We must save our own skins. The girl, and at once, it's our only chance."
Whittington hesitated, but for hardly a moment.
"You have orders? From him? Naturally should I be here otherwise. Hurry, there is no time to be lost. The other little fool had better come too."
Whittington turned and ran back into the house. The agonizing minutes went by. Then two figures, hastily huddled in cloaks, appeared on the steps and were hustled into the car. The smaller of the two was inclined to resist, and Whittington shoved her in unceremoniously. Julius leaned forward, and in doing so the light from the open door lit up his face. Another man on the steps behind Whittington gave a startled exclamation. Concealment was at an end.
"Get a move on, George!" shouted Julius.
The chauffeur slipped in his clutch, and with a bound the car started. The man on the steps uttered an oath. His hand went to his pocket. There was a flash and a report. The bullet just missed the taller girl by an inch.
"Get on, Jane!" cried Julius. "Flat on the bottom of the car!"
He thrust her sharply forward. Then, standing up, he took careful aim and fired.
"Have you hit him?" cried Tuppence eagerly.
"Sure," replied Julius. "He isn't killed, though. Skunks like that take a lot of killing. You all right, Tuppence?"
"Of course I am. Where's Tommy? And who's this?"
She indicated the shivering Kremenin.
"Tommy's making tracks for the Argentine. I guess he thought you'd turned up your toes. Steady through the gate, George. That's right. It'll take him at least 5 minutes to get busy after us. They'll use the telephone, I guess, so look out for snares ahead. And don't take the direct route. Who's this, did you say, Tuppence? Let me present Monsieur Kremenin. I persuaded him to come on the trip for his health."
The Russian remained mute, still livid with terror.
"But what made them let us go?" demanded Tuppence suspiciously.
"Oh, I reckon Monsieur Kremenin here asked them so prettily they just couldn't refuse."
This was too much for the Russian. He burst out vehemently.
"Curse you! Curse you! They know now that I betrayed them. My life won't be safe for an hour in this country."
"That's so," assented Julius. "I'd advise you to make tracks for Russia right away."
"Let me go, then," cried the other. "I have done what you asked. Why do you still keep me with you?"
"Not for the pleasure of your company. I guess you can get right off now if you want to. I thought you'd rather I tooled you back to London."
"You may never reach London," snarled the other. "Let me go here and now."
"Sure thing. Pull up, George. The gentleman's not making the return trip. If I ever come to Russia, Monsieur Kremenin, I shall expect a rousing welcome and—" But before Julius had finished his speech, and before the car had finally halted, the Russian had swung himself out and disappeared into the night.
just a mite impatient to leave us," commented Julius as the car gathered way again. "And no idea of saying goodbye politely to the ladies. Say, Jane, you can get up on the seat now."
For the first time the girl spoke. "How did you persuade him?" she asked.
Julius tapped his revolver.
"Little Willie here takes the credit."
"Splendid!" cried the girl.
The colour surged into her face. Her eyes looked admiringly at Julius.
"Annette and I didn't know what was going to happen to us," said Tuppence. "Old Whittington hurried us off. We thought it was lambs to the slaughter."
"Annette?" said Julius. "Is that what you call her?" His mind seemed to be trying to adjust itself to a new idea.
"It's her name," said Tuppence, opening her eyes very wide.
"Shucks," retorted Julius. "She may think it's her name because her memory's gone, poor kid. But it's the one real and original Jane Finn we've got here."
"What?" cried Tuppence.
But she was interrupted. With an angry spurt, a bullet embedded itself in the upholstery of the car just behind her head.
"Down with you!" cried Julius. "It's an ambush! These guys have got busy pretty quickly. Push her a bit, George!"
The car fairly leapt forward. Three more shots rang out, but went happily wide. Julius, upright, leant over the back of the car.
"Nothing to shoot at," he announced gloomily. "But I guess there'll be another little picnic soon."
"Ah!"
He raised his hand to his cheek.
"You are hurt?" said Annette quickly.
"Only a scratch."
The girl sprang to her feet.
"Let me out. Let me out, I say. Stop the car. It's me they're after. I'm the one they want. You shall not lose your lives because of me. Let me go."
She was fumbling with the fastenings of the door. Julius took her by both arms and looked at her. She had spoken with no trace of foreign accent.
"Sit down, kid," he said gently. "I guess there's nothing wrong with your memory. Been fooling them all the time, eh?"
The girl looked at him, nodded, and then suddenly burst into tears. Julius patted her on the shoulder.
"There, there, just you sit tight. We're not going to let you quit."
Through her sobs, the girl said indistinctly,
"You're from a home. I can tell by your voice. It makes me homesick."
"Sure I'm from home. I'm your cousin, Julius Hirschheimer. I came over to Europe on purpose to find you, and a pretty dance you've led me."
The car slackened speed. George spoke over his shoulder.
"Crossroads here, sir. I'm not sure of the way."
The car slowed down till it hardly moved. As it did so, a figure climbed suddenly over the back and plunged headfirst into the midst of them.
"Sorry," said Tommy, extricating himself.
A mass of confused exclamations greeted him. He replied to them severally.
"Was in the bushes by the drive, hung on behind. Couldn't let you know before at the pace you were going. It was all I could do to hang on. Now then, you girls, get out."
"Get out?"
"Yes, there's a station just up that road. Train due in 3 minutes. You'll catch it if you hurry."
"What the devil are you driving at?" demanded Julius. "Do you think you can fool them by leaving the car?"
"You and I aren't going to leave the car, only the girls."
"You're crazed, Beresford. Stark staring mad. You can't let those girls go off alone. It'll be the end of it if you do." Tommy turned to Tuppence.
"Get out at once, Tuppence. Take her with you and do just as I say. No one will do you any harm. You're safe. Take the train to London. Go straight to Sir James Peel Edgerton. Mr. Carter lives out of town, but you'll be safe with him."
"Darn you," cried Julius. "You're mad. Jane, you stay where you are." With a sudden swift movement, Tommy snatched the revolver from Julius's hand and levelled it at him.
"Now will you believe I'm in earnest? Get out, both of you, and do as I say, or I'll shoot."
Tuppence sprang out, dragging the unwilling Jane after her.
"Come on, it's all right. If Tommy's sure, he's sure. Be quick, we'll miss the train."
They started running. Julius's pent-up rage burst forth.
"What the hell?"
Tommy interrupted him. "Dry up. I want a few words with you, Mr. Julius Hirschheimer."